everybody. Here's the intro.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
I don't know. Should I make that shorter? Should I make the intro shorter? I don't think so. It's Radio Mysterioso, and the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal are on the air with us right now. Let me turn down that music. This is professionalism.
Oh, my God. It's great working with professionals, right?
Yeah, exactly. Of course.
Exactly.
This weekend in Boston was the Monster Mash? Mad Monster Mash? Is that what it's called?
The Mass Mystery Weekend.
Oh, Mass Mystery Weekend. Why did I think it was the Monster Mash? You try to look that up on online, and all you get is, what's his name, Bobby Sherman? No, who did that? Boris Pickett. Yeah, Bobby Boris Pickett. This was a event that was in Boston this weekend, hosted or at least produced by Tim Banal, who is here, and two of the important guests and friends of Radio Mysterioso who were there speaking that weekend and are on the phone with us right now. Peter Robbins, best known probably for his book Left at Eastgate about the Bentwaters incident and so many other things. Tim calls him the mayor of ufology, which I think is appropriate. And Nick Redfern, author of too many books to name, but most recently Science Fiction Secrets, and that can be gotten from Amazon, and you can read about it in different places. I'm still plowing through it, and then I'll put up a review, but not on UFO Mystic, because UFO Mystic appears to be broken right now.
Ooh.
I couldn't even announce the show.
It's definitely the government, Greg.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It's always the government. So, how was the conference, you guys? You know what? Nick has to get up early in the morning. He's being a wuss. So, we'll let Nick describe how the conference is.
I knew it. I knew that's where you would go.
Yeah,
I got a 4:30 call, Greg. So, I'm going to be a night owl. But, the conference went very well. This was my second time at the conference. I spoke here last year as well. And, you know, I was very sort of pleased by the fact that the hall itself was packed both nights. You know, there was barely an empty seat in there. You know, and never mind the kind of the UFO climate, but the general economic climate as well. I guess everybody kind of wonders when they're arranging conferences nowadays what the response is going to be. Mm-hmm. And to actually find it was, you know, I think double, at least double last year's and capacity audiences, that's good. And I like when a conference, we were discussing this earlier, I like it when conference organizers don't necessarily stick to one subject, whether it's UFOs or ghosts or whatever, but they're kind of, I guess, trying to entertain and inform the audience with a whole wide range of subjects, whether it is UFOs, cryptozoology, ghosts, conspiracies, you know, you name it. I think there's something to be said for, you know, no pun intended, don't alienate one aspect of the 4chan community at the expense of another. And I think this particular conference achieves its aim very well. It brings in a whole range of people that can, like-minded souls who can share ideas and listen to hopefully stimulating lectures. And I gave one lecture on the Friday night, which was on crashed UFOs. And, you know, I wondered about how to do this. I was originally asked to do, like, a history of crashed UFO lectures, but, history of crashed UFO incidents. And I thought, well, you know, I don't just want to reel off a bunch of dates, places, claims, etc. So I kind of looked into some of the more alternative aspects of some of these incidents. I started with Roswell and talked about the fact that at the old base hospital, which is now a rehabilitation center, a number of the nurses and employees there claim to have seen ghostly, spectral little figures wandering the corridors, the theory being that these are, I guess, like the spectral, ghostly remnants or the souls of the bodies found at Roswell. So I talked about an investigation I did out there with Josh Warren and Jim Mars about 3 years ago, to where we literally had a seance in the old hangar, Hangar 84 at the Roswell Army Airfield, and with a couple of psychics to try and conjure up the souls of the Roswell dead. So I kind of did that, you know, go off on a tangent. And then Saturday night it was basically just a full-on lecture on my various trips to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabra and addressing the different theories and ideas as to what it may be, where it lives, the history of the sightings and the reports and a lot of the witness testimony. So, you know, I enjoyed the fact that both nights were completely different. I was able to sort of get across different aspects of the research I do and why I do it.
Yeah, yeah, it was kind of a paranormal poo-poo platter.
There you go.
Exactly. You know what? I forgot to
quite like that, but you're not far off.
I forgot to interview Tim Binal,
yeah,
too.
Right.
This is Tim.
The place was packed. I feel really happy about it. I couldn't ask for it to have gone any better. So
it really went off great, Greg. We're sorry you weren't there. You would have fit in perfectly.
Yeah, well, it's Tim's fault. I forgot to introduce Tim Binal, who's the host of Binal of America Radio, among other things, and who was the producer, I guess, of this event, Tim?
Yeah, I was the producer, so, you know, yeah, don't worry about the intro. I mean, I kind of chimed in anyway, so. thanks for having us on. I feel like I was saying earlier before we started the show, like, we finally can cut our album now, because we've got Peter in one room and Nick in the other. I'm in the kitchen, and we're all on phones. And now, you know, it's going to be like a jam session, I think. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I said it was like Joe Meek's recording studio, which was basically his house in London. And he put different instruments, musicians in different rooms, and he mixed from like the kitchen or something like that. So
that's pretty much what it's like. Yeah,
that's what's going on.
Yeah, it was a really good time, and even today, you know, the rain was crazy today for the bus tour, but it was really cool, and it ended up really well, and all the people were happy and stuff, so that's really what matters the most, and they learned a shitload, because he had so much, there was so much material being presented, and even, you know, Nick and Peter had stuff to say, too, so it was like bonus material for the people who came along on the bus trip.
Nick, who has to wake up early, what did you learn on the bus trip?
Oh, jeez.
Well, I learned that Massachusetts is a seriously weird place. joking aside, what I did find is that right in the heart of where we were after a short drive, you have a classic window area that in many ways parallels some of the places in Britain I've investigated, or arguably, you know, locations like Point Pleasant in the 60s, where you had a whole range of Mothman, UFO, Men in Black, poltergeist activity. This one area that I'm sure Tim will be able to talk a lot more about, the Bridgewater Triangle, where, there's been a whole lot of Bigfoot reports, ghosts, ghost black dogs, big cats, UFOs, you name it, you know, the sort of thing you see here, there, and everywhere in these window areas. So that for me was kind of intriguing to learn that. And, you know, I always like to get out and see these places personally, even if it's pouring down with rain. So that was a plus as well.
I don't know if people see things in inclement weather. You don't hear about usually, you know, the saucer came down in a pouring rain, although there have been some of those.
Peter,
what did you speak on this time?
Me?
Yes, you. What was your talk? And why was it new?
I gave the organizers a choice of about 10 topics, and they came back to, you guessed it, Rendlesham Forest UFO incident.
Right. So, there's people there that are kind of, I guess, paranormal virgins, if you want to, poo-poo platters, virgins.
Well, you bring up a very good point, actually. This was a crowd that I was not used to speaking before. Most of these folks are very involved in ghost and spirit investigations, hauntings, assorted paranormal activity, and UFO is very much the peripheral topic for them. Quite a number had certainly heard about the Rendlesham Forest incident or seen, you know, some treatment on a television documentary. So what I endeavored to do was to lay out kind of a sort of sweeping but compact picture of the events involved, and then give examples of some of our best evidence. I had a really good photographic backup for the talk, and I got to spend three of the four last weeks, three of the 4 weeks of September in England and Scotland. I spent almost a week of it back in Suffolk, so I was able to revisit all of the most significant Rendlesham-related sites, re-photograph them, so I had some wonderfully fresh material of some of these locations that I kind of gave everybody a walking tour of at the end. As I think you know, Greg, some years back, the Suffolk Forestry Commission kind of caved to sort of public desire to not downplay this event. And the town or county council allotted something like £10,000 to create a UFO walking trail.
Yes.
Which is very well marked with, you know, beautiful hardwood posts, each one with UFO trail on it, or a little picture of an alien with a symbol. And Suffolk Park Forestry Ranger once a week will take people on a several-hour, several-mile walking tour. They do, however, work from a very tight, rather cleaned-up script, but it was quite a novelty to walk through those woods that I know fairly well and see all of these goofy markers with the little aliens on them.
What was I going to ask? Oh, you know, did you bring up the, since these are people that are into psychic, well, just general weirdness, did you bring up, which I always found fascinating, the Cloudbuster Reich angle to this and the part of the forest that was basically swept through by a big, nasty, weird freak storm?
That's a great question. I actually didn't on this talk simply because it was specifically aimed at the incident, the events that comprise the incident itself. However, last month at the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, I did focus in on that. In fact, I gave a talk on Reich-related technology, and it all culminated in some very shattering photographs and backup material of those terrific amounts of forest damage that happened in October 87 during the quote-unquote freak storm that swept through that area and a good deal else of England and Wales.
Yeah, maybe you can quickly explain what I'm talking about the Cloudbusters and about the freak storm and what happened there and how strange it was, actually.
An area that's interested me, actually, since I was a teenager and that I have been very involved in on and off in my life is the life and work of Wilhelm Reich. Years ago, when I was in therapy, my therapist was Reich's first assistant for the last 11 years of his life. And for your three listeners out there that have never heard Dr. Reich's name, he's as controversial a figure in the world of science as has come at us in the last couple of millennia. Among his other groundbreaking discoveries apparatus was a machine that he called the Cloudbuster, which had the absolute documented ability
to change weather patterns, and if properly used for the better. He's very patriotic, loved America very much in a way that really is special with people who have emigrated to this country, and he managed to escape Hitler's Europe right before it closed in on him and loved America very much. The only reason I bring up the point is that he had supplied schematics for this apparatus to the United States Air Force in the 1950s, copies of which, interestingly, ended up in the case file of the FDA when they went after him. But I was confronted in the late 1980s, early 90s, in doing research for Left at Eastgate with the fact that my co-author, as well as two other independent Air Force witnesses, absolutely maintained that there had been a huge scaled-up trailer-mounted cloudbuster just off of the main runway at RAF Bentwaters in Suffolk. I was not thrilled about this because the last thing we needed in an already controversial story was more controversy. But when we first visited there in 1988, we walked into a terrible scene of destruction. 4 short months earlier, a storm of unprecedented destruction had swept into the southern part of England without warning, and within several hours had taken down something like 1.3 million trees, mature trees. And this is a Suffolk Forestry Commission stat. They called it a hurricane. Hurricanes are moisture-driven. Not a drop of rain fell. It went on to do some tremendous damage in other parts of the United Kingdom as well. But essentially, I posed the thesis that the Air Force used this apparatus to create this, either because they couldn't control it or because they were looking to use it as a weapon. And in any case, it is tragic and very chilling. But that's the short treatment of that story.
Okay.
Let me ask. Sorry.
I'm glad that you said thesis.
What's that?
I'm glad that Peter said thesis, because a lot of this stuff we talk about is not proven, but we use working hypotheses and then try and support them. And until, you know, majority of people think that the thesis is supported, you have to, well, even then you still have to say thesis. Tim, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to ask Peter then. I may be getting the dates and locations wrong, so correct me. That siren's not coming from here.
No, it's coming from here. We always get sirens. I leave the window open because it's hot here.
Oh, don't tell us that.
Yeah, it's like 80 here.
Oh, so sorry for you, Greg. Wiping a tear away right now. There's snow on the ground outside Massachusetts.
I know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You rat.
yeah, Nick got to see snow for like the first time in ages. So.
There was some in Angel Fire.
The storm thing, could it have been used to sort of like wipe clean the area after the Bentwaters thing, or was it, you know,
well,
a long time after or far?
Actually,
far
it was 7 years after.
Oh, okay. All right.
So the events are not connected. I should also add, because I gave a talk at one of the very few dedicated laboratories, scientific laboratories in the world, that really focuses in on replicating Reich's earlier experiments and building on them. It's located just outside of Ashland, Oregon, and they had a terrific conference on developments in Reich's work in early August that Dr. James DeMeo, who runs the laboratory and is probably the most experienced cloudbuster in the world at this point, only man in the world to have a PhD in it, by the way, from the University of Kansas, that he has been able to provide information to back up these allegations of similar freak storms in a few locations in Europe very closely associated with American air bases.
Well, that's new information.
Yeah,
yeah, people should check out James DeMeo's work. I've talked to him a few times, and
yeah.
he talks over my head on some things, but he takes great pains to actually explain what his work is, what he's doing, and how Reich's stuff is not dead and it should be paid attention to, because there are a lot of benefits that could come from building on his research. Go ahead.
He is an extraordinary guy, and the laboratory is quite something. It was the first time in years that I've gotten to use an orgone energy accumulator every day, and quite a powerful one, and several cloudbusters on the property. For anyone more interested, seeking more information, responsible information on this technology and other aspects of Reich's work, I would direct you to either the Orgone Biophysical Research Laboratory's website, or just Google Dr. James DeMeo, DeMeo, and it'll take you to the site and his wonderful bookstore, etc., in a few hits.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, since we haven't heard from Nick in a while, and he seems to want to go to sleep, I heard...
Nick is asleep.
Wake up, Nick.
No, I'm fine, honestly.
Give him some coffee. Kick
him. Understand his Texas accent, by the way.
I'll see if people can understand this heavy Texas accent that he has. I mean, he's got to realize that there's people listening from all over the world. Tim told me about the, and you knew I was going to bring this up, the UFO roundtable discussion on Friday night. And it sounds like it turned into a bit of a show. I heard Tim's take on it. What about you, Nick? I suppose you were there.
Yeah, it was, it was basically, you know, something that I enjoy doing, where you have, I guess, like direct interaction with the audience. I think that's, you know, that's always a good thing, because it helps us gauge what the audience thinks, and it helps us pick up on their views, ideas, and perhaps, you know, even stimulate a good debate. And I always think that's a good, positive thing at conferences. You know, you get to learn a lot. The audience gets to learn quite a bit about the mindset of the speaker, and vice versa as well. So, you know, I'm always up for doing stuff like that. And, we got a good debate going, a lot of different questions asked. For example, I think one of the most important ones was, you know, how to push the UFO subject forward, what needs to be done, what might break it open, if it can be broken open, to take things to the next level. You know, we talked about things like educating the, for example, this is one of Peter's main areas, educating people, particularly, you know, younger people. I spoke about how, really, you know, I think we're not really able to, I guess, wait for the government to tell us, even if they know. You know, I think if we get the answers, it's going to be through unpredictable means. I don't sort of go with the classic landing on the White House lawn, nor do I go with the idea that one day the president, prime minister, or queen is going to reveal the truth. I think it's going to be via, if the truth ever surfaces, whatever that may be, I think it's going to be through accidental or alternative means, and that may unfortunately mean we have to wait for a response from whatever the intelligence is that lies at the heart of the UFO mystery. But as I pointed out, you know, it's been a silent partner for however long that situation unfortunately might continue to be the case. It may never wish to have an open contact with us. So that was, you know, that was one of the areas that we touched upon in this debate as well.
Yeah, but I also heard that there was some sort of... I want to hear about the chair throwing.
I'll retell it so I can make sure that it's the most politically correct.
And I do want to get to that controversy about what to do with UFO study and all that. That was in my questions for all of you. So, but go ahead, Tim.
I think it was just sort of an oil and water situation, really, between Jeremy Vaney, who we all know and love, and John Horgan, who was the producer, the executive producer of the show. He was the man behind, you know, really getting this thing off the ground from the very beginning, like 4 years ago, and I just joined on board as the producer this year. And it was just an oil and water type of thing, I think, and John's the kind of guy that once he gets to know you, he really warms up to you, but he hadn't even met Jeremy yet, so he didn't get Jeremy's personality like we all kind of do. And that uncomfortable introduction between the two of them played out in front of the audience during the panel discussion. So, it was interesting. If I wasn't the host of the panel, if I was in the audience, I would have found it wildly entertaining. But since I was up there with the microphone, presumably in charge of, you know, orchestrating the whole panel, I didn't quite know what to do with my baton. But it all worked out in the end. They hugged it out after the show was over and stuff. And then,
hugged it out?
In keeping with John's personality, you know, he went down and checked out all the stuff at Jeremy's table, and then the next day he's like, oh, I can't believe I got in an argument with this guy. I didn't realize he was, you know, so prolific, and he's done all this stuff. So, you know, maybe it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship, and we'll look back on it that way. So I try to, you know, look at it on the positive end, and I think, you know, for the most part, my mom was in the audience, and she said, I thought they were joking. So I'm hopeful that, you know, nobody took it too seriously, and it seems like it was just sort of a weird situation. But, you know,
yeah,
that's
well,
what you kind of hope for with a conference.
Well, I characterize it wrongly. I said chair throwing. It was more like kind of a surrealistic moment when people didn't actually know what the other person was talking about, and they had to get over that. That's what it sounded like to me, actually. Any, like, totally weird-ass, off-the-wall, wacky question? The thing is, when Tim told me about what he was going to do and how he's going to set this up, and instead of have a round table, have kind of like an audience participation, I thought that was great, because usually it's just, we speakers are going to tell you what we think, and you have to all shut up. So I thought it was a good idea to have the participation in there, because, people, like you said, people want to get into people's minds. Or Nick said, into people's minds about what they're doing, what they're thinking, where they're coming from, you know?
Right.
So,
well, I did poll the audience, like, at the beginning of the roundtable to see where they stood sort of on when this disclosure thing might happen, for lack of a better term. I would say it was inconclusive. I mean, it looked to be about a dozen to 15 people for within the next 10 years and the same amount of people for, like, within the next 20 and then never. So, it was hard to really sort of gauge their feelings on things. And unfortunately, when we did the Q&A part, I just think people are shy or something. They really didn't want to ask too many questions, and we wanted to squeeze in a lot of special guests. So
right.
It wasn't as much as that, but I think that I'm sure that Peter and Nick can tell you the interaction with the audience throughout the whole weekend was intense. Like, you could... The audience had really unfettered access to these guys, and obviously hats off to them, because, of course, you know, all kinds of people want to talk about all kinds of stuff, especially when we get people like Nick and Peter in town, and they want to share theories or tell them their story and stuff. So it's great that they can do that, you know, like I said, in unfettered fashion, which was really cool.
Yeah, you're right there, Tim. I think, you know, there's... Most conferences, you know, hopefully, I think, unfortunately, you always get one or two occasionally where you get a lot of speakers who, sometimes you get speakers who can be a little bit standoffish and don't want to mix with the audience and vanish after the lecture, and I think that's totally the wrong way to do it. You know, we're just presenting our theories, ideas and views based on our research. At the end of the day, the most important people are the witnesses and the people with the stories to tell. Without those, we don't have anything. So I think that's one of the most important reasons for having good audience interaction, that it actually brings in new information that we can perhaps deal with and get a clearer picture of what's going on, hopefully. I think that's why audience interaction with the panel, with the speakers, is so important, because there is that give and take and sharing of ideas is crucial to understanding what's going on.
Yeah, and like I tried to stress to the audience too, like both nights, it's awesome that they came out to a conference and stuff, and here's a great opportunity to do more, whether it's join up with one of these groups that was there or talk to some of these experts and stuff and you know, sort of make the right connections and really dive into this, kind of like what happened with me, because, you know, if it wasn't for that first X conference and actually meeting Peter, who really sort of gave me the boost to keep going with this, you know, we wouldn't even be doing this.
Right. There's the audience interaction, here's the nasty untold part of the UFO thing or the conference thing, is that sometimes you get crazy people that don't let other people talk.
We actually had almost a vacuum on crazy people.
Oh,
and
good.
You expect, you know, that a few of them will be assigned to your conference no matter what. I found the people that I spoke with overwhelmingly to be just terrific folks with serious interests in their, you know, specialty focus, many of them quite scholarly and with years of experience and study. A lot of it for me was really quite an education as a novice for the main part of the conference yesterday. And this bus tour that we had today lasted about 5 hours. And although the weather was awful, we had Tim and John and Andrew Lake, extraordinary scholar on paranormal activity in New England, and one or two other people contributing literally in tandem as they went. And everybody on the bus, I think, had a terrific afternoon. But truly, this is a part of the country that is as loaded in terms of paranormal activity as, you know, other areas that I'm familiar with are with UFO activity, whether it's Bonny Bridge, Scotland, or the Suffolk area, which also has quite a bit of paranormal activity as well.
Right, yeah, well, Nick mentioned there seem to be these window areas where you will, if you see a lot of activity in one kind of genre, you will see other things. Gabe Valdez told me that Dulce recently is heating up now. No cattle mutilations, but plenty of other weird stuff. Bigfoot, psychic stuff, and more strange flying lights.
Wow.
So that's, actually, you know, it'd be a good idea to have him on an interview.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, good luck with that.
Well, you don't think
well,
you'll do it,
I
huh?
was going to ask, and I meant to ask either one of Nick or Peter, like, throughout the whole weekend, so I'm glad you mentioned this, Greg.
Yeah.
Has anyone, and you guys would know, one of you three would definitely know, has anyone actually, with the exception of, like, the whole ley lines thing, has anyone actually sat down and tried to, you know, do a map of some kind with these areas taken into account, almost like a topographical paranormal map?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not aware of anyone. Are you, Nick?
No, personally not, unfortunately. I wish I could say yes, that I do know someone who's done that. But
I am.
I'm waiting for somebody. Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm aware of somebody.
I think it is interesting, though, that if you look at a lot of these window areas, a lot of them seem to be centered around forests and thick woodland. Again, why that should be the case, you know, I don't know, but I can think of, you know, two off the top of my head in England, one being Rendlesham Forest and the other one being the Cannock Chase, two areas of prime weird 14 activity. And, of course, over here, you've got the Bridgewater Triangle, which is just, you know, dense woodland. Now, okay, you could argue that there's a lot of woodland around the world, so that may have something to do with it. But you do seem to find where, you know, the woods are thick, that the strange things, I think, as well.
I do know of somebody that's doing that.
What's that?
I do know of somebody that's doing ley line research and trying to see if places where they intersect are kind of magnets for weirdness, and that's Sesh Hari, who wrote Wonder of the Worlds, who I've had on this show, and he seems to think that there is a definite connection. My sometime co-host Walter wrote a book about it, called Latitude 33, about Disneyland and the possible idea that the people that planned Disneyland put it there for a specific reason in that place, rather than just it's a nice place to get a lot of people to come. I got to see more on that before I make the decision as to whether a ley line or an earth energy thing is behind a lot of the weirdness that goes on and window areas, so-called. But it's a compelling theory, and we discuss it on this show quite a lot.
Nice.
Yeah, everybody's quiet now, so I got to go back to my question.
Yeah, come on. Entertain us.
Well, you know what? I like hearing stories about weird, strange things that happen at conferences. Like, you know, somebody, I'm still waiting for somebody to stand up and yell wrong when I'm talking, you know. Because I've had practically had that happen, but this sounds like a pretty like what you would expect a conference to be. People there to find out information, exchange information, and talk to people that they've always wanted to talk to face to face.
Well, let me tell you, I've spoken at more conferences than I can remember, and for a smaller conference, this was brilliantly well organized. The details, the kindnesses, Tim's tremendous hard work and organization, along with John Horrigan, his remarkable wife Jen, their terrific team of volunteers, they made all of us feel extremely welcome. The thing moved along at a great clip. Tim set a great tone as MC. It was really nice and informal. Everybody had plenty of time to hang out with whomever they wanted to. I got to meet Lauren Coleman, one of my heroes, whose work I followed for decades now, and found him to be one of the nicest people I've ever met. It was just all in all a terrific, terrific weekend.
Yeah, you should have seen the connection between Peter and Jeff Belanger. They really hit it off.
Oh, what a jerk. I hated him. Yeah, and I hope that he listens to this show. I was horrified. I was amazed. I was going to buy his book, but he made me trade for a copy of my book. That was the only downside, meeting Jeff. It almost ruined the weekend for me.
Isn't he based out here in California?
No, he's a Massachusetts boy. He's been here for as long as I can remember.
Oh, okay. Because when I was doing Weird California, I actually called him for a quote and some advice, and he was really helpful. And for some reason, I got the impression that he is out in California. I do not know why.
Well, but, you know, Greg, he wrote one of the sister books. He wrote Weird Massachusetts,
right?
Which is great fun. Don't tell him I said so.
And he spoke at the conference, obviously.
Yeah.
The people that were there, were they kind of savvy to the subject matter, or did it kind of go all over the map? There were ghost people and cryptozoology people and Bigfoot people, and what was the audience breakdown kind of?
I would say you got it. It was ghost people, cryptozoology people, and Bigfoot people, all of whom seemed to have at the least an appreciation or an interest in, you know, the other areas. They were there in part to hear about maybe their, you know, special subject, but also to be open to whatever they could learn about anything else. Everybody mixed nicely. I didn't see the crypto zoo people hanging out in one part of the room and saying bad things about the abominable snowmen people, and same for the ghost people who were having the rest of us haunted. Everybody got along nice and played well together.
Yeah, yeah. It was really quite a cool mix of people, and
that's not what Greg wants. Greg wants scandal. Unfortunately, we don't have any.
Yeah, well, let's make one up for him, for goodness sakes.
Well, I didn't want any scandal.
Jeff, but that's easy.
I think it's nice that people get along.
The older gentleman who came to the conference like 20 minutes late.
Oh, yeah.
And,
well, yeah, he was a little crazy.
Yeah, but endearing, so we can share some stories.
Not dangerously crazy.
So, what's that?
Not dangerously crazy.
Exactly.
No.
Friendly
crazy.
So he came to the thing late and was confused about the address, even though he was there. And so we directed him inside. And then he stormed outside and was like, "That lady at the table said it cost $25 to get in. That's ridiculous. I know more about UFOs than anyone in that building."
Mm.
And so we were like, "Wow, all right." And the documentary crew was there, so they chatted him up, and I went back inside to, you know, keep an eye on everything. And I came back out like 15 minutes later, and this dude was still talking to the documentary crew, and it was like freezing cold out. And I was like, "Dude, just come on in. Like, you've gone above and beyond. You showed you really care about this thing if you're willing to talk about it for 15 minutes outside. After you decided not to go to the conference because they charge too much. So just come in, get out of the cold, buddy, and enjoy the show." And I was like, as soon as you're done talking to the crew, you know, as soon as you feel like you're all set. And as soon as I finished talking, he just spun on his heel and started walking inside. And the film crew was like, whoa, hold on, are you done? And he's like, "I want to go see the show." So it was pretty cool. And he seemed to have a good time afterwards, so.
He sounds like that guy that comes to the conferences and sits outside the door each time so he doesn't have to pay to go into the conference.
Oh, jeez.
At Ryan's conference, you're right.
Yeah, he was at Ryan's conference, but apparently he's been at other ones, too.
Yeah, I remember.
No, I'm
just
not...
offer to volunteer and help out. You can get in. Jeez.
I'm not trying to dig for you know, turds here. I just wanted to hear if there was anything, because there's always some weird-ass story going on behind the scenes, and if you're organizing the thing, you kind of have access to it. That was really nice of you to let the guy in. I'll remember that next time, and I want to go to pay for a conference.
One of the reasons, Greg, why I think why it ran so smoothly was because you had a lot of people, I think, from my impression, like, for example, when I gave the lecture on the Chupacabra, a lot of people in the audience had obviously heard of it but weren't that familiar. So, in other words, whether it was Peter's lecture or mine or Jeff's or whoever's, there were significant elements of the audience that were there, as Peter said, to learn about their own subjects, but also to learn about everybody else's. So, rather than, you know, it being like your typical UFO conference where everybody knows everybody and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff going on, everybody was just focused on the lectures because, in many respects, it was all new to, certain aspects of the lectures were new to them. So it pretty much was just like an audience that was concentrating on the lectures, and that was the entire thrust of the event.
Well, here's a question for all of you. We all, you know, all of us here, and I've talked to all of you, know that there's connections between all these different areas, between UFOs and cryptozoology and hauntings and ESP, parapsychology, and usually the conferences are on one subject or the other. And it seems like maybe that's changing and these things can start to cross-pollinate. Do you think that's happening? Any of you think that's happening? And is it a good thing? Of course it's a good thing. But
I don't know if it's changing. I mean, this conference was specifically designed to bring these subjects together, which I thought was a very good thing. And there's certainly room for more conferences, you know, so structured. At the same time, focused conferences on specific areas of these and other studies, you know, are tremendously valuable, especially to those of us who are so wrapped up in, you know, kind of the narrow focus of exploring UFOs and their implications. Again, I thought it was a really good thing, and I'd like to see more conferences like this. I don't know if it signals any sort of trend. Either you guys have a sense of that?
I think, certainly on the one hand, you know, that I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's a good thing that it wasn't just a UFO conference or just a ghost conference. I think when you've got, you know, 5 or 6 hours of lectures, that it is good to break it up and allow the audience access and exposure to different areas. Now, I think the area that Greg was kind of more veering towards is whether or not there was an acceptance or the ideas were put out that many of these things were interconnected. I think to a large extent the lectures were sort of self-contained, whether it was UFOs, ghosts or whatever. But, you know, I think there is a good thing for saying that we need more exposure on the angle that whether these, I guess, like cross-pollination cases and trying to understand what's going on. For example, you know, the Roswell ghost story. Well, Roswell's the UFO capital of the world, but then you find this paranormal spectral creatures seen to this day in the old hospital. How do you tie that in? You know, then the whole thing like DMT and cryptozoological links. And, you know, I think it would be good to kind of see more exposure given to, like, the unified field theory for all these different phenomena.
Yeah. That's one point we really didn't even explore, I think, was the connectedness of it. It sort of was almost like an underlying, like a given almost, I guess, in a weird sort of way. It was like, this is all paranormal, and there's probably some connection, but, you know, God knows if you can figure out what yet.
Peter?
Say again, the question?
The question was, do you think that there is a, well, you did address it, that's right. Do you think there's a connecting link here? And who's dialing numbers? Do you think there's a connecting link in here, and can that is that something that can be researched successfully?
Yeah. My gut answer would be not necessarily, no.
That's surprising.
I've never, again, it's a question I've never paid attention to. Is there a link between hauntings, ghosts, yetis, other kind of paranormal stuff, and the subject of UFOs? Certainly in some cases, there seems to be some kind of crossover or association, but I don't know if that's an exception to the rule or sort of a subjective judgment based on the fact that certain of these activities concentrate, dissonant as they are, in similar pieces of geography, and that, you know, some people will draw the conclusion that they are, as a result, related, as opposed to just coincidental. I'm damned if I know. I don't know.
Did the TiVo go off just now? I had to run downstairs to shut my TiVo off.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, that dialing sound was...
Oh, yeah, it might have been the TiVo. I disconnected my TiVo. I don't want them knowing what I watch.
Too late now. Well, not for you. For Tim.
I like them to know. That's okay if they judge me.
I figure they're...
Peter saw that I watched Survivor, like, as soon as he got here. And it's like, this show is horrifying.
I figure they're gathering marketing material, and I just don't want to contribute to it. I'm just paranoid, whatever.
Well, duh.
There is something to be said for paranoia.
Before we sort of, like, move into other questions and stuff, I do, because I know Nick's getting near his curfew. I wanted to...
He's drinking his warm milk right now.
Like, just how overwhelmingly generous with their time and stuff. Both Nick and Peter have been all weekend. I mean, you know, like a couple weeks ago I talked to them and I was like, all right, I got you on this bus thing too now. And they're like, okay, that's cool, no problem. And then it was like, when they got here, it was like, hey, we're going to do Greg's show on Sunday night if that's cool with you guys. And they were like, yeah, that sounds great. So, you know, they've just been super generous and they let me rope them into all kinds of stuff all weekend. And I really appreciate it. And, you know, maybe they're kicking themselves, like, secretly, like, why the fuck did I even get involved in this crazy thing? I was on a bus.
Yeah, we've been being nice, Tim, but the fact is we've had an awful weekend. You know, we hated spending all this time with you. We're just humoring you because you paid us the big bucks to be here, and, you know, that's what we do. We're very superficial, very self-involved people.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, my view is that, you know, what we do is an interest and it's a passion. And if you want a boring life, you know, do something else. And, you know, for me, I enjoy the interaction with the audience of sharing ideas, going to new places, trying to understand what the hell's going on with these wacky subjects we investigate. And, you know, I think you should embrace it because you're a long time dead, you know, and there's lots of things out there to be resolved, and you can have a memorable time in the process of informing people as well. So, you know, I'm always up for, you know, for doing this sort of thing because it adds to your life as well as, you know, getting facts and figures out into the public domain as well.
Yeah, well, you get to a conference and you're standing there going, oh, what do you want to do now? Well, if there's something already set up, you know, it's great. The Fortean, the Fort Fest people would always set something up like that and said the speakers were invited to go. They weren't forced to go, but every speaker would go because we would get to go to the Dime Museum and we'd get to go to a haunted house and whoops, things like that. So, yeah, it's not to put down the generosity of Peter and Nick, but, you know, if you got a chance to go out and do something new, you know, I haven't been to the, what, Bridgewater Triangle. I'd go in a second, of course. And I think it's so cool that you set that up.
One of the reasons I wanted to be here. This is not an area of New England I'm really familiar with, the Bridgewater Triangle, as opposed to the area outside of Boston where Tim lives and where we are now. Plus the opportunity to be at such a different kind of event. I had met John Horgan for the first time when I spoke in Exeter, New Hampshire a month and a half, 2 months ago, and thought he was just a great guy, although we had corresponded quite a bit leading up to this. And It was, you know, to reiterate, it was an altogether terrific event, and I'd be proud to be a part of it at any time in the future. And I hope anybody in the greater New England area or who has friends in New England or maybe just a little discretionary cash at this time next year for Mad Money will join these great folks here. It was just a superb weekend.
Sounds like fun. I wish I could have been there.
We do, too.
I know. I told you, dude. I feel awful. I really wish you could have been there.
Oh,
I'm not. I'm already sort of, you know.
I'm not trying to make
you
feel bad.
Because the success of this event this weekend really, I think, is going to open a lot of doors for next year. And it's going to be our fifth year, so we're hoping to really do something spectacular.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it did well. And then you called me a couple nights ago, and you said, I don't know how many people are going to come tomorrow. And Peter knows this. Walk-ups are usually, am I not right here, twice as much as your pre-sales.
Very often, and I'm glad you used the word walk-ups instead of walk-ins. That one always is a bit disquieting for me.
Yeah, so I was surprised by the walk-ups. Like, this is a first-time thing I've ever done it, so it was cool to really... I learned so much in the last 6 months, you know, and to be able to really learn how to put on a conference is something I've always wanted to do, and John just gave me the keys, like, in February. It was like, take this where it needs to go. And we did, and it was just, like, really cool. And I'm looking... I've been thinking about next year since, like, a month ago. So I'm already excited about that and what it's going to be like.
You know what? I had like five questions I wanted to ask all of you, but since we're coming up to the hour here, and I guess Nick wants to finish his warm milk and go to bed. and there are probably people listening that either don't know who Nick is or much about what he's doing. So maybe he can talk. Nick can talk about what he's done. And my personal question, which I wanted to ask everybody, was what started you, and how have your ideas about it changed? I mean, how have your ideas evolved since you're all sitting here right now? But let's go with Nick first.
Let me just take a sip of that warm milk and get my slippers and hot water bottle.
He's gonna go to sleep halfway. He's gonna go to sleep halfway through the answer, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, my views when I first got into this whole, I guess, the 4TN world, was everything was pretty much black and white, as I think is the case for everybody, that UFOs were definitely alien spaceships, Bigfoot was definitely an unidentified ape, and the Loch Ness Monster was definitely a plesiosaur, a surviving dinosaur. You know, I think everybody goes down one of two paths. Either they stay rigidly in that particular realm, or they realize that the sheer body of evidence suggests that there are crossovers into other areas, or there are anomalies within their one sphere of research that just don't sit well in the accepted viewpoint of what's allegedly going on. For example, there are a number of cases on record, more than a handful, where people have tried to photograph what they perceive to be the Loch Ness Monster for their camera to jam. You know, there are instances within the UFO subject of that happening. There are Bigfoot reports where I've got a couple on record where people saw Bigfoot crossing the road as they were driving down a road for their headlights to go out on the car and for the engine to stall, things like that. We have UFO encounters that seem in some respect, or alien encounters, to parallel incubi and succubi reports. And yet in those cases, you know, the people adamant that they were seeing something demonic rather than something alien. So in other words, for me, my view of rigid, completely unconnected phenomena, albeit strange phenomena, has went away a long time ago. And I do think to a large extent we're dealing with one or two phenomena that in some ways that we don't really understand are interconnected. And that from ways that we also don't understand, they seem to not just have a relationship with us, but they seem to need a relationship with us as well. It's like a two-way thing, I think, but, you know, we're still looking as to what might be the motivation behind that. But I think there is a unique relationship between the phenomena and us. So that's sort of how my views have changed, I guess.
All right. I just picked up we'll go to the other two. I'll take a little musical break, mainly because I wanted you guys to hear this song that I just found. Do you know that song that came out in the 50s with the guy from 77 Sunset Strip? Kooky, Kooky, Lend Me Your Comb.
Ed Burns, of course. Yeah.
Ed Kooky Burns. I found a parody done by Spike Jones called Kooky, Kooky, Lend Me Your Tomb.
Oh, no. Better play it.
Halloween's coming up. I want to play this, but we'll be right back. Probably not with Nick Redfern. And, oh, you know, I must say, thank Nick, if you have to go to sleep, thanks so much for staying up and staying on, and I hope I see you soon.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
And
see you later.
Thanks. And be sure
Greg,
to...
Go ahead. Greg, I'm going to say goodbye to Nick because he has to get up at 4:30 in the morning, and I may or may not be up then. So.
Okay, well, you'll have about...
I'm definitely not going to be up then.
Good night, Nick.
Goodbye.
See you later, guys.
Thanks,
Nick. I will be right back as well.
Okay. And well, I'll put that question also to, there goes Nick, to Peter and Tim. Anyway, I'll put the question also to Peter and Tim, the same question, because you've got different perspectives. Tim's only been here doing this kind of stuff for about, 3 years, and Peter's been doing it forever, so I'd like to get that perspective. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm already kind of thinking about what I'm going to say.
Yeah,
so
see, I give you time to formulate your answer. Meanwhile, here's...
I'm hearing Peter's answer, so you better get the MP3 of this up soon, because I want to hear
what
he has to say.
It's
but
spooky,
I will say goodbye to Nick, and I'll be right back.
All right. It's Spooky, Lend Me Your Tomb, apparently by Spike Jones, here on Radio Mysterio. So we'll be right back now with Peter Robbins and Tim Binall.
Spooky, spooky, lend me your tomb. Spooky, spooky, oh, drag.
Well, now let's take it from the top and grab the same roof. I'll dig you, baby, till you're cool and stiff.
Spooky, spooky, lend me your tomb. Spooky, spooky, crazy.
Just split for the mold shop and I'll meet you inside. We'll have a sundae topped with formaldehyde.
But spooky, spooky, wild.
You've been bugging my plasma ever since you made the scene.
You're the utmost.
You just make my skull stand still with your lips of blue and cheeks of green.
The very utmost. Spooky, spooky, lend me your tomb. Spooky, spooky, nutty.
I've got my jets lighted and my flaps are going to bend. We'll play corpse and robbers. It's a game, that's the end.
Spooky, spooky, lend me your tomb. Spooky, spooky, oh, drag.
If you ever cut out, just take me where you are. Baby, take all of me, but seal up the jaw.
You're a regular drag the knife.
What's with this tomb, caper baby? Why do you want to latch on to my tomb?
I'm setting up a wild gig tonight. And my pad isn't big enough to hold all the cats. Yours is the utter McUtmost.
Well, I'm beamed in on Screamsville, and I'm moving right now, cause you're the kind of a chick who swings. Baby, you're the lynchiest.
Hey, that's apparently Spike Jones in a later period parodying the Kooky Kooky Lend Me Your Comb by Ed Kooky Burns and Connie Stevens, which I will play at some point. But I think a lot of people have heard that. We're back with Tim Binall, who's the host of binallofamerica.com radio, and Peter Robbins, most well known, I would think, for Left at Eastgate, the book about the Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest UFO incident of 1980?
Yes, sir. December 80.
All right. You know what?
30th anniversary coming up a year from December.
Would you guys help me sometime at a conference? I want to do a UFO Jeopardy.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that do you like that idea?
I think it's a great idea.
Have UFO researchers come up and do a UFO Jeopardy, you know, just with cards or whatever, and I guess they win books or whatever. Anyway, or the adoration of their fans or their colleagues or something. But UFO Jeopardy, very tough questions about, you know, history of UFOs, ufology.
I could see that. And people playing at home, of course, on home UFO Jeopardy.
Yeah. I always wanted to do that because I want to be challenged. One of the people
you
on
are great.
I'm not challenged. I'm different. I'm specially abled.
paranormally.
Yeah, paranormally abled. On what was it? The Paracast. They had somebody on one of their people put up a UFO questionnaire thing that was about 100 questions long, something like that, on the history of ufology. Did you either of you guys see that?
No. I think I did see it. I did come across it.
I posted it on
tried
UFO.
I halfway through it, and I probably quit because I would be embarrassed by how I did. I'd be like, and then afterwards, I'd be like, oh, obviously that's the answer type of situation. So, like a New York Times crossword puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. I posted on it on UFO Mystic. I think if you do a search when it's working again for UFO quiz, it'll probably come up. I got two wrong. I'm proud of my out of 100 questions, I got two wrong. And one of them had to do with Phil Klass, and I can't remember what the other one was. However, before we went to the break and before Nick before Tim went and tucked Nick in so snugly in his bed, I asked Nick, and he answered, you know, what got you involved and how has your thinking changed? Because everybody in this has a certain idea when they come in. They read certain things, and then a lot of them, especially the intelligent ones, like Present Company, have their ideas changed a little bit and start to think for themselves and think maybe what we're being told here by all these people is not exactly what's going on.
My story is pretty simple. I did not get involved in this field because of intellectual curiosity. I got involved because more than 30 years ago, my sister Helen told me about her memories of something that I found extraordinarily disturbing that I've now dealt with hundreds of times with people all over the world. Truly archetypical, detailed memories of an episode of UFO abduction. And that changed me overnight, and I became very involved in the work literally within days. And my career basically jumped the tracks, and I never was able to really get back to it. But when I first started to study the subject, my main assumption was that we were dealing with the general cliche of other intelligences from other planets or solar systems that were visiting us in highly advanced technology coming and going with impunity for reasons we could only guess at. Over the intervening decades, I still think that's very tenable, and I think that is part of what we're dealing with here. But I've become equally open to some of the other hypotheses. Obviously, there's no way to prove that of the truly anomalous UFOs, and I'm discounting here all of the weird, if explainable, other things, advanced terrestrial technology that's highly classified, remarkable weather anomalies, misinterpretations of semi-conventional or conventional objects, that we are likely or as likely also dealing with intelligences possibly from other dimensions or other times or other somethings I don't even know the word for, because here I am sitting here in the third dimension on Earth, you know, stuck in my own little reality. I've become a lot more respectful of what I do not understand, and at the same time, extremely critical and rigorous in my research. I am very nuts and bolts. Martians do not channel messages to me. I don't know how many types of other intelligences there are visiting us and what exactly their crafts look like and what they eat for breakfast, where I have met people who maintain they do know those things.
Yeah, they're out there. Yeah, and in my story, I guess, is, you know, I come from a whole different world time-wise from Peter and Nick, because I got into this, like, in 2004. I think my attitudes were sort of in keeping with what a lot of the mainstream America has, you know, that the UFOs are aliens, and the government's covering it up, and that the secret may be revealed someday or something like that, and that there's people working to, you know, get it revealed, being the ufologist. And then I got more into it, and I think, like, the ExoPol boom was starting when I got into it, and I sort of got roped into that at first, and then sort of realized more and more that as I talked to people and became friends with people like you guys, that this sort of thing's been going on for, like, decades of, you know, the answer's right around the corner, the government's talking right now about telling everyone about it and that kind of thing. So I started to realize more and more that that was just a recurring trend in ufology. But I stuck with it because I was like, well, that's sort of interesting in and of itself, that this keeps happening and that people keep believing that it's going to be right around the corner, that there's always this carrot and the stick thing going on where they're always trying to reach something that just keeps getting pulled away from them. Seemingly to them at the last minute. So, and then my attitude just changed about the phenomenon because the more I met people and talked to people and heard what they had to say, you know, they had really interesting, incredible perspectives on it that were completely different. Like I said to Jacques Vallée when I interviewed him, I was like, you completely blew my mind. You came up with stuff that I never even would have considered to think of. And so now it's like the further I get into it, the less I know, which is kind of bizarre, because when I got into it, I thought I pretty much knew that that's what it was. And now it's like, no way, dude, you don't know anything. Are you kidding me? Like, nobody knows anything. That's the scary part. And I've just been open to all these different ideas and probably more cynical, I guess, because I started out thinking and sort of being all bullish about disclosure because that's what I had first got my taste of in ufology. And now I've gotten a little more cynical where I'm like, it's probably not going to happen, and ufology is too fragmented. And you know, my whole bent is really on the sociology of it all. So I find all kinds of stuff, you know, just getting more into it to be able to meet more people and learn their stories and how they got into it and stuff like that has been really good.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the disclosure thing, and that's been a big thing for a while. I think it still is a big thing. And I know immediately when you mentioned that, Peter was thinking, because I think at the MUFON conference, was it, Peter?
Yeah.
You did a presentation on disclosure and problems with it. Now, I've got my own ideas about it, which I've written about. Nick has too. But
yeah.
What did you say in that paper?
Well,
your criticism, I guess, of the disclosure that you, from your point of view.
Yeah, and it is specifically my point of view, certainly not MUFON's, of which I'm only just like a regular member, and some people may share the view, but that would be completely independent. I should start out by saying that even in using the word disclosure, I was faced with sort of a philosophical challenge, and it caused me to completely rewrite the paper after the deadline for getting it into MUFON for their symposium. So there's a much more updated version of it, which I'll be glad to send you and you're welcome to post. It's a pretty extensive paper. It runs about 25 pages, and it's one of the few papers I've written in the last years that I'm happy for people to just send out and have it go viral. I think it deals with some very important subjects. What I'm saying is that the word disclosure, to start with, has so effectively been co-opted, and I don't even mean that in a bad word way necessarily, by Stephen Greer and the disclosure movement, which I have quite a number of disagreements with. So it's a perfectly good word, but and it has almost no synonyms, and so rewriting the paper was something of a challenge, but for me, using that word, quite simply, is a reference to the disclosure movement. The title of the paper, I think, was finally Religion, Politics, and Human Behavior, Roadblocks on the Path
to declassification and dissemination of UFO-related material. Among the points that I put forward was within both the exopolitical community and the disclosure movement, you've got a lot of decent motivated people that want to see, you know, this stuff come out. But it's just kind of become a rallying cry without much thought given to some of the more subtle and overt implications of just doing this. You know, the three of us here right now on the air, we've studied this, we've lived with the idea, we've learned about it, and I don't think, you know, if the United States government chose to open a good part of their files, you know, we would freak out or, you know, have nightmares. It would probably confirm things that we think we know and have some surprises, but we are not indicative of the public at large. And this is not something that you can do that will only affect a percentage of the population. Releasing this information is releasing this information, and it goes not just all over the country, it goes all over the world. It goes out to people with every type of belief and faith and background and psychology, and some of them are simply not prepared for it. There are people who simply don't care. It's time, we want it now, and let's go. Some of my particular concerns revolve around not so much the religious community at large, and in fact, after reading a number of studies and spending time with a number of ministers, rabbis, some Catholic prelates, I'm pretty convinced that although people will have some sleepless nights, people of faith overall, this will not, you know, destroy their belief in God or cause a crisis in the great organized religions of the world. If anything, it may be used to put forward the idea that, you know, the miracle of creation is confirmed way out in the cosmos or in other dimensions and all that stuff. You know, people who believe that Jesus is Messiah will continue to follow that belief. I am more concerned for fundamentalists of all religions, people who by definition share a belief with others based on their holy books that is not open to any interpretation whatsoever. And I have directed at some of my Christian UFO fundamentalist colleagues some very rough questions, which I think overall they answered with great openness, even though they weren't pleasant, that are in this paper. You know, there's no room for, say, bringing up Ezekiel. Ezekiel is Ezekiel, and that's it. Their feeling overall, and I'm not speaking out of school here, this is what they have put forward publicly and certainly to me, is that there are no such things, for example, as extraterrestrials. It never happened. There's not one living advanced being on any other planet from here to the great brick wall at the end of the cosmos. How do we know this? There is no reference to it, neither the New or Old Testament. And again, there's no room for arguing. For them, it is all about revelation, and these are signs and portends of the second coming and the end times, and above all else, we should be looking to see them. When I put forward, well, what about incidences where for some decades now, advanced military technology and certainly NASA have been able to follow craft that seem to be under intelligent control coming in from deep space? And their answer is basically the devil understands this, and he sends the craft that are really filled with the minions of Satan out into deep space so they can come back and we can confirm, you know, our attitudes. They look the way they do because, well, that's the way we want them to look, or that's the way they look in science fiction, and, you know, the Satan can make that happen. There's no arguing. And for me, that is very dangerous. And I don't mean to single out Christian fundamentalists. I'm sure there are Jewish fundamentalists and certainly Islamic fundamentalists and others who would share functionally identical, rigid points of view. And these things are problems. And there are other problems as well that I discuss in the paper.
Yeah. I got. Oh, go ahead, Tim. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, a conversation we had on the ride in from the airport when the guys came in, and we were sort of talking about all this, and I totally agree with Peter's point about the word disclosure and just the power of words, and you know, obviously there's all these sorts of issues with the exopolitical movement in general, but we have to, I guess, give credit where credit is due that they figured out the problem that a lot of people in ufology have, where they're always like, well, if we weren't ufology, things would be better. And they came up with this whole exopolitics thing and really sort of created their own divergent branch and smartly lost the whole UFO part of it. So we need to, if we could figure out a new ufology name for us, you know, people who want to try and take ufology in a different direction, sort of like what we had talked about previously, Greg, you and I, about theoretical ufology type stuff.
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
So it's, you know, I guess, as I'd like to learn, you know, watch what the exopols are doing and see what they're doing right. Because obviously we know about a lot of the stuff that they're doing wrong. So we might as well learn what they're doing right as well.
You bring up a good question, and I will tell you something that they are doing wrong. And the same thing, disclosure. A good example is Dulcie. The events associated with Dulcie are important parts of the mythology, the lore, the legend, legends associated with the UFO phenomena, and in fact may be or may have been part actual events that occurred. However, nothing, and I'm referring here also including the so-called paperwork that's come down to us, allegedly leaked or something, I don't find it tenable. I don't buy that particular argument that we don't know for sure that this happened. And if I hear one more person refer to the Eisenhower Treaty of 1954 with the aliens, I think I'm going to commit a felony on their ass. It's completely irresponsible. It is without any foundation. You can say, you know, there are those of us that feel this absolutely happened. That's fine. Identify it as such. But don't casually refer to these things as facts when we have not established that they are. It reflects poorly on the field. It is a sign of very sloppy research. It makes us much easier to attack and much easier for the people in the mainstream that we want to read some of the same materials that we've read, to review some of the same evidence we've reviewed over the decades, to put them off more and say, well, here's just another example of somebody talking through their hat about an underground battle between aliens and American military, and there's nothing to back it up. This is completely irresponsible, and it's being done on both sides, and with even wilder stuff than that.
Absolutely. Like earlier, right before the interview, we were watching the news, and the infamous UFO balloon man story has been dominating the news. Right.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I was going to ask about that.
The minutes of the hour-long broadcast was just balloon man, and apparently they had someone on that had talked to him, and of course they just went right down the road and said that the guy, the dad there, believes he's a reptilian theorist. You know, he believes in the reptilian theory, and he specifically said, you know, that he thinks Hillary Clinton is a reptilian. So it was like, wow, dude, this is not good.
And we're not saying she's not, of course. But, yes, exactly. That's a perfect example. When you bat something like that out, it does become like the balloon boy story. And even today, as Tim's saying, we were watching the TV, CNN before, hooking up with you on radio now. And, you know, they're already bringing in Roswell and reptilians. And all of a sudden, you know, a tremendous amount of cheerful damage is done because a couple of irresponsible idiots, you know, want some publicity and it goes bad, and they're now in legal trouble.
Right. Somebody asked me, I was just on Miles Lewis PSYOP radio, and they asked me about that too. And they said, do you think this is bad for the field? And I said, no. You know why it's not bad for the field? Because it's not going to make any difference in what anybody thinks. What's going to make a difference is something positive that comes from outside the UFO field, probably, from some other discipline that is sort of a stepping stone to helping us understand what paranormal things are, what the UFO thing is, and then people will stop laughing so much. Meanwhile, if, you know, the balloon boy gets in the news, people are just going to laugh even more at the same thing they were laughing at before. It makes no difference, really, to me. I think it changed nothing.
Well, the only thing I think that it really might affect is sort of the attitude of people who may have sightings and stuff like that. Maybe they might be more reticent to report them or more skeptical of what they see, which might be a good thing in the long run, the skeptical part. The reticent part, of course, is not. But at the same time, you know, that's kind of like a low rung, I think, in a way, of ufology sometimes nowadays, the case reports, just because, like, we've got 50 years of them. It doesn't really change anything. You know, that's just sort of the foundation of the field and just keeps going. But I don't know exactly if all this accumulation really is beneficial. Obviously, it's beneficial, but I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, there's oversaturation of UFO case reports at this point anyway. So, you know, we can live with a downturn of sorts.
The other thing I wanted to ask Peter before we get off, before we got off the disclosure thing, as I'm sure Peter and Tim too, you know my attitude about the disclosure thing, that, you know, we don't know what there is to disclose. We've got a certain idea of what the disclosure is going to be about. That might not be what's sitting in a file somewhere. There might not even be a file saying there are aliens coming from other planets and we know it.
Maybe part of the reason for covering it up is that we know damned little, or we know something that's very chilling, and we are afraid of that classical bugaboo mass panic or something, or we do not know. You're right, and philosophically, it's an interesting question, as well as actually, we don't know what we want them to disclose, except we want them to disclose whatever they have, and that may be something that produces a result that is counter to all of our best interests. And do not get me wrong. I am not somebody who feels that the government, you know, should hide this information, certainly to some degree.
Right.
At the least right now, I feel what we should be seeing in this country is something akin to what's already happened in at least a dozen countries and what's going on right now in the United Kingdom, a staged declassification of at least some UFO documentation, in their case, somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 different documents coming out over the next 10 years, over the next 2 years, on a dedicated Ministry of Defense website. I also appreciate, and I discuss it in the paper, that the ridicule factor is so powerful and so virulent and so destructive and so ingrained into our culture that now is probably not a great time for our president to do that thing, or that if it were to be done in the next year or so, that it should be done directly out of the Department of Defense, or, you know, he should have a certain amount of plausible deniability, because, I mean, just imagine if word got out right now that President Obama had some interest in the subject of UFOs, the right would have a field day, and a good part of the left would, too. What are you dealing with this nonsense for when we have real problems that need to be solved? Politics is a chess game, and you can't make any move at any time. You've got to think it through, anticipate the implications of it. It's a shame that we can't be more spontaneous in a way in this area, but, you know, they could easily say, okay, you know, here's 5,000 low and mid-level documents. It's good PR. It's good interim education for people. Should we ever get off our butts and release this information, at least there'll be a little more understanding and acceptance. And in fact, it might be a healthy thing for society. We've studied, you know, the 13 countries that have done this, and nothing detrimental has happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if the secret were revealed tomorrow anyway, we know damn well that large factions of ufology wouldn't believe a word of it, or wouldn't believe, you know, every sentence there'd be a different camp that had an issue with whatever the press release was that disclosed the UFO phenomenon. I think we'd see the field go from where it's kind of, I guess you could say, it's similar in a way to the Bigfoot field, where it's an overall super mystery, let's say, that everyone sort of is trying to figure out, It would go from that to then into a JFK assassination-style genre, 9/11 conspiracy theory-style genre, where it's like different factions just debating the cover-up. It would become like a Roswellian field where it was devoted mostly to, you know, dissecting what the government told us instead of us trying to figure out what it's all about.
Mm.
Yeah, there's the other problem of what term have you defined as what's being disclosed? And Tim touched on this too, and Peter as well. If the people calling for this release of documents don't hear or don't see or don't read what they've already decided in their minds is the truth, what, you know, are they going to say that's a lie too, whether it is or not?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, it's almost like, you know, barbershop mirrors that reflect each other and go on forever. One could even make the argument that stuff that, you know, it's all been some grand deceptive scheme, and that the thousands of documents that have come out are riddled with fake documents, or that the Ministry of Defense has created thousands of fake documents and is releasing them now. But for what reason? You know, it's an awful lot of work for an awful minor result on a certain level.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And, of course, the other thing that I always am concerned about when it comes to disclosure is just getting credit where credit's due for some of these old-time ufologists, because I'm always afraid that if the government ever disclosed the secret, these guys would be even more marginalized. And some of them, like Stan Friedman, would be celebrated, but, you know, the vast majority would be pushed aside by scholars and academics and stuff like that, and it was just disappointing because, you know, their stories will be told eventually in dusty old books devoted to how this thing was before we knew what it was, you know, and so you always got to watch out for that kind of thing, too.
Well, see if you have a reaction to this. My basic idea is that if whatever it is that's causing these things is admitted to, even in ignorance, the UFO field will immediately be swept aside and be irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
I wrote about this a couple years ago, and then Nick wrote about a year ago. And I think there's some fear in some quarters that if there is some sort of disclosure, nobody's going to listen to ufologists anymore. They're going to listen to a scientist from whatever university, or, you know, somebody that's quote-unquote qualified to talk about these things, not somebody who's been doing research and releasing government documents and been talking about it for years, like a Stanton Friedman or Kevin Randall or somebody like that.
Yeah, yeah. There'll be a lot of disbelief, especially from people in ufology. I think that it would be interesting to see their reaction and how they would take it. You know, that's really, I think, in a way, for me, that's kind of why I stick around with this whole thing, because I'm waiting for the payoff just to watch the story unfold payoff-wise. That's kind of how I felt during the whole Bigfoot body hoax last year, because for about a day it was like it actually had some steam where you had a little bit more hope than usual, and I was like, this is going to be amazing and fascinating to watch how these people react if this thing is real. So, you know, that's really what I hope for. I cheer for the story, as most journalists say.
Talking about these different subjects, we think about who's giving us this information, who's doing the research. And here's a question for both of you. Who do you think is doing good research that's going to maybe take a step somewhere, maybe not break things open, but somebody everybody should be listening to who is good speaker, good information, level-headed, etc.?
Wow. I know, that's a tough one. I mean, not to cite, you know, favorites per se.
It's just an opinion.
As objective as possible.
I'm putting you on the spot to try
and... I know. Yeah, well, as far as the most disturbing aspects, which revolves around the abduction phenomena, which I am convinced is central to understanding at least some of what the whole UFO subject and its implications are about, disturbing as it is, the work of Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs is absolutely crucial. It's not fun, but it's very important. Right now, I'm very pleased, even proud, that
my friend and colleague Linda Moulton Howe is doing some very important work on the Rendlesham Forest story. For more than a year, she has really been digging, and she has been working very closely with one of the original witnesses, certainly as important to the story in his way as Larry Warren is, except that he has more recently come forward, and that's John Burroughs. Linda will be speaking, I believe, on a new witness next month at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Nevada. But you can go to her Earth Files website and learn about some of the stuff for yourself. Anybody jump into your mind, Tim, that you really admire and respect as presenter and scholar?
I think, I feel like I'm going to be kissing his ass here, but I definitely think Nick in a big way, because
yes.
He covers so many different areas, and that sort of goes back to what we had been talking about, how there probably is this kind of interconnectedness, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of people just don't want to stray from their own area. But Nick does.
Well, Nick is almost a Renaissance figure in this, and he has worked very hard to study so many dissonant areas of the non-standard, whether it be UFOs or government cover-ups or mystery animals, cryptozoology, etc. And, of course, he's a great presenter. He's also got a lot of guts and, not adverse to going against whatever establishment he's addressing.
Right, and he makes it okay, I think, for other people to feel the same way, and that's sort of what will push it forward.
Yeah, I think the best of us have to be our own best skeptics and very, very critical of sloppy methodology. I'm a perfect example of a very plodding nuts and bolts researchers. My three mentors were Bud, who I met a year after he got into the work, and when I got into it more than 30 years ago, a wonderful old ufologist, gone for some years now, Komen von Kavetsky, who was a staff officer for the Hungarian army during the war and in charge of all photo reconnaissance, photo analysis, and photo education for the Hungarian army during the war, disciplined guy, and maybe more than anyone in a way, another great, great contributor to the field who doesn't receive nearly the recognition that he should, a former tough-as-nails New York City police detective named Pete Mazzola, who the first edition of Left at Eastgate is co-dedicated to. He also happened to be a crack UFO investigator and taught me to investigate the subject the same way that law enforcement personnel investigate criminal activity. You've got a situation. You begin with deductive reasoning, and you eliminate possibilities working from the most mundane up to the most extraordinary, which is something I learned when I was 12 years old from Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, who's also one of my heroes, fictional as he is, in this work. And unfortunately, I see people who should know better, who, because they have already established in terms for themselves and for some of us, that yes, UFOs are real, and some of them are likely, very, very likely, advanced machines of undetermined origin from places unknown. They begin in a new case investigation with that assumption, and it may not be that. If you don't hold yourself to a high standard, the work will suffer. And people will think the less of it because you haven't made the case.
Absolutely, yeah. And, obviously somebody like Mac Tonies, who's just trying to throw out new concepts into the mix, are always the people that, you want to pay attention to, because chances are we're all trying to find that, like, last remaining piece of the jigsaw puzzles are connected all together. Marie Jones is someone who's doing some amazing work, actually, too, that I don't want to forget to mention. Her book, Science, with a P. P-Science, I guess, P-S-C-I-E-N-C-E. Amazing stuff, talking about new science and, how all this quantum stuff and nano stuff and that thing they have in Europe, I forget what it's called, but it keeps breaking.
The Hadron Collider.
What's that?
The Large Hadron Collider.
Yes. you know, she's talking about how all this, how those things may end up being the key that unlocks a lot of this stuff. So, I mean, her work's amazing too.
Yeah, see, this is what I was talking about, that something that's discovered outside of the discipline of studying reports and things like that might be the linchpin that turns things. Something that comes from an established discipline that people accept with an extraordinary twist, with an extraordinary provable hypothesis.
Yeah. I'll also add to that very short list my friend and colleague Rich Dolan.
Oh, yeah.
Whose new book is remarkable, not for some miraculous reason, but because of a tremendous amount of hard, hard work, investigation, and research. He's a great presenter. He's very articulate. And he is also laying out some thoughts, possibilities, and questions that have not quite been put forward in the way that he is. It's a book any of your listeners should consider adding to their UFO-related libraries, and if they don't have the original, the first edition in the series UFOs in the National Security State, they should add that too. He's already working away on number 3.
Wow, I didn't know that. I'm not on the distribution list, so I haven't seen National Security State 2 yet. Maybe I should email him and ask him what's up.
Maybe you should, yeah.
Now,
it's terrific. I'm about halfway through it right now and did a certain amount of the proofreading and a bit of contributing to the Rendlesham Forest treatment.
Uh-huh.
But it's quite an amazing volume. It is, I think, close to 600 pages as well, so don't drop it on the pet cat.
Yeah, I did not mention earlier that people could call in, because usually I don't want people calling in to the last half hour. If you would like to ask Peter Robbins or Tim Banal any questions, that's 213-252-0998. And they'll be on for about another 20 minutes. Tim brought up, and I know he's on board with a lot of the new stuff, and Peter, I would say, is probably a bit more traditionalist. I've been trying recently to push for something called theoretical ufology as a legitimate piece of the of UFO research. And a lot of people, especially old hardline people, is like, well, that's just all airy-fairy stuff, and it makes no difference to anybody what counts are, you know, reports and hard data and all that. But the hard data and reports haven't really gotten us any further. So building on things like Keel and Vallée, and then to a lesser extent people like Keith Thompson, maybe even bringing in the psychedelic stuff like Terrence McKenna and Rick Strassman. Do you think there's any fruit there, Peter, that it's worth it to have a sort of subset of UFO study called theoretical ufology?
I'd welcome it. There's no reason not to. It can't hurt. And anything that increases intelligent, thoughtful dialogue in this area of study can't be bad. The worst thing is to, you know, just put your back to the wall, defend your theory, and keep a closed mind in an area where we should all be having particularly open minds.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we need to do is just try everything, I guess. We've been doing the UFO case reports forever, and it's time to try maybe different tactics, I guess you'd say. What they are, I have no idea, but, you know, just pure case reports hasn't done the job. So what I've been doing recently, too, is just sort of doing a sort of quiet straw poll amongst my friends and guests on the show to get their take on, you know, kind of what we said earlier, what could be plausible and workable moving forward. And Peter's stuff about educating, you know, really doing a concerted effort to educate people in schools and kids and stuff like that, I totally agree with, and some I never even thought of. So, you know, eventually after I've talked to enough people, I'll sort of have enough to present, I think, to a general audience as far as, you know, a point-by-point case for what maybe needs to be done to move forward.
How would you do that, though? How do you introduce a paranormal curriculum into the school system. That would be take an incredible amount of effort and have an incredible amount of inertia against it.
Well, to kind of go back to how we got onto this, on the panel discussion on Friday night, Tim introduced as a hypothetical question, if money was no object, what do you feel would be, you know, a valuable or most valuable thing that you could do right now to advance the study? I don't think any amount of money is going to, you know, get the government off its butt on this.
Right.
And what I just theorized was, if there were a way to begin to educate educators, you know, hold seminars for university professors, elementary school teachers, child psychologists, sociologists, psychologists, but find a way, maybe through key people in, you know, education, to open the possibility within science or history classes to discuss that there is this controversial subject and phenomena, and that people are, you know, quite drawn apart from each other and their opinions of it. I think one place that would be great to begin the study is one that's a focus of mine, namely looking at where the heck did this derogatory attitude, what I call the ridicule factor, come from? And that's simple enough. It kicked in the week the phenomena kicked in the summer of 1947.
Right.
You know, you read contemporary coverage that is contemptuous and sarcastic and absolutely insulting to witnesses and to reports. It is not only nothing new, we were seeing these same treatments, some of them even worse, in the New York Times in July of 1947. And then contrasting them with fully authentic, totally vetted, unquestionable documents, of which we only have several thousand, from military branches and various agencies and organizations and offices within our government, showing how real and how concerned the forces that be were about it. I gave the talk I gave in Exeter 6 weeks ago in New Hampshire was just that, and it was merciless, and the audience completely got it, and this was not a UFO audience. All I did was lay out several dozen pieces of reportage that were fairly representative, in this case, from, say, 47 to 52, wow, and intercut chronologically, and some of these documents came out 24 hours after a bad, idiotic report, and they completely counter it. You see that it's been a setup, that we have all been had. Our parents have been had. Our grandparents have been had on this. But the result has been absolutely effective. That factor of ridicule is so powerful that I could tell you right now a couple of names of people at the highest levels of government that would like to talk to us about this, or at least not be afraid to express an intelligent, thoughtful opinion on it, and will never do it given the current and ongoing and historic climate on the subject.
Absolutely. And I think the government and the people, you know, who may be sitting on more information, whatever it is, I think that they really, if anything, would love for, if they really wanted to get out, obviously, would love for like a new Roswell situation where they could almost have a fresh start. But they'd be like, you know, we didn't, presuming they know, you know, what the hell's going on, they could just say, we never knew all along until now, but now we do, and sort of get that, you know, get a clean slate on the whole mystery. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if things unfold in that sort of way.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I think it's very easy to ridicule these things. It has been for a long time, basically because of the mindset of what our education is and what the power structure is and how these reports basically throw right up in the face of things how little we know about things and how much there is to know, based on, you know, being thrown at a society where we're being told that we know everything there is to know. There's just a few more things that are going to slightly change the theories we have now, but that's that we pretty much know it. And to come in and say, well, no, we don't, it would be a slap in the face. So the best thing to do is to ridicule it. And like I said, it's very easy to do it with the mindset, I don't know about in other countries, but in kind of a Western democracy mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's much easier for them to do that. And they've kind of created their own problem in a way. It's become a self-perpetuating mystery because it's just piled up too long now where the accountability factor and the distrust of the government would be like almost too much for them to deal with after the fact, which is why, you know, like I said, I think if they would welcome a fresh start at this point, more than anything.
Who would welcome a fresh start? You mean everybody?
Actually, maybe in a way, now that you say it, you know, when you put it that way, I think maybe to the average person, they don't want to deal with some crazy revelation that the government's been covering this all up for 50 years. They'd be much more happier if they were told that the government didn't know anything all these years. But luckily, a UFO crashed in Roswell in 2017. And, you know, that's when it all happened. Sort of like how the old adage about how whatever the government has is, whatever we have is 20 years behind what the government has, kind of thing.
Or, yeah, well, whatever we hear about. There's another side of this, too. To come out and admit they don't know anything and are powerless. But the thing is, if they don't know anything and are powerless, why hasn't anything changed? Obviously, whatever it is doesn't really want to change us. Otherwise, it would have done it already, right?
Presumably, but we, you know, with the whole abduction thing and the hybridization theories and stuff, you know, they may be very patient, these whoever's behind all this. The alternative intelligences, I guess you'd say, not the government.
There is that part of it right there.
And whether or not we'll see the result of that in our time, you know, any of us can guess, but... boy, it is a son of a gun, and it is the 900-pound elephant, as far as I'm concerned, in UFO studies. Although that's fairly light for an elephant, isn't it?
Yes. You couldn't pick it up with a flying saucer-shaped balloon, I don't think.
Probably not. Now, Greg, are you going to try and replicate, you know, a similar situation with? Because I know you do a lot of flying and stuff. You know, I think it's ripe for you to create your own sort of UFO flight thing and, you know, get on the news.
Unfortunately, if I flew at night with what I have, I would get arrested. You're not allowed to fly after sunset.
Oh, we need to fly you right in the daytime, like Balloon Boy.
Oh, totally.
Oh, okay.
Now, let's get you some publicity. I think we can get one of those balloons, put you in it, and send you up and get an awful lot of publicity.
Okay,
you
well...
You may get your own reality show out of it.
Yeah.
With any luck at all, if you want to call what you do reality.
I try to stay as far away from reality as possible.
I could see At Home with Greg Bishop, you know. Oh, that would be nice. Yeah, people think of the old Joey Bishop show. I know it would ring a bell.
I kind of visualize it as the, remember Playboy's Penthouse? There was a show called Playboy's Penthouse.
The camera closes in. On your fireplace lair, you're lying on a bearskin rug surrounded by yetis and grays and ghosts. And, you know, hi, in a smoking jacket, of course, with
yes.
a pipe. Of course, they're all nude. You know,
yes.
I mean, you'd want to go for that kind of angle. For
well, you know what? I would prefer them to look like David Huggins' paintings of the women, the alien women that he's had sex with.
Excellent. Now, there you go. There's your first guest.
Does anybody know if... because
they look like Earth Girls to me. Call me crazy.
Yeah, and none of them are blonde either. They're all brunettes. Every one of them is brunettes.
Well, there you go. Remember, they were brunettes in V, and you know what they were like. They weren't pleasant at all when you peeled their skin off.
Yeah, well, but and V.S. Boas woman had, what was it, white hair, I think?
Wow!
Yeah, she had white hair. She looked like a new wave singer. But by the way, I have to thank Peter again for taking the picture of Nina Hagen and I at the hangar, because otherwise I was too scared to ask for a picture, but I knew Peter would do it.
Nina was awesome, wasn't she?
Yes.
What a great broad! I really liked her. I think she's really something else. But yes, that was a Kodak moment to be sure.
Yeah, well, Peter had introduced her, and I knew it. I knew asking him would be the right move. So I did.
Yeah, that's usually how I fall when I'm in a tough situation and Peter's around.
I defer to Peter
him for advice. He sort of guides me through some of these situations.
So you guys,
you defer to Peter, or you think to yourself, what would Peter do?
Exactly. Oh no! I'm afraid I'm not going to live that one down. Thank you, Greg. Oh dear. So, do we have any calls coming in or email coming in for questions?
You know what's weird? I've got more listeners than I've had in months.
Great! Wow.
And no calls. 213.
You know what? They're so enwrapped in our every word, I guess. That, you know, who wants to take a moment out to dial a number at the keyboard?
213-252-0998. And I must warn you, if the next show comes in, we'll have to get off of here in about probably 5 to 10 minutes. However, I've gone through all the questions I had, but I did have another for both of you. And it's kind of a thing that a lot of people close with. What are you working on now, Peter? What can we expect from Peter Robbins in the next few months?
I'm working on a couple of papers, specifically one about my personal memories of my very first job in ufology, which was to work as an editor on a paper about UFO reality for then United Nations Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, before we knew he was an old SS member. He was quite supportive of a UN UFO initiative, and I was able to attend all of the relevant special political committee meetings of the General Assembly, along with guests such as Alan Hynek and Stanton Friedman and Jacques Vallée, addressing, you know, representatives, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I will actually be giving a talk on that next month in Nevada. I'm also doing a reappraisal of the Voronezh, I forget the Russian pronunciation.
Voronezh.
UFO incident of 1989, which I think is a very important case, but happened in that crucial year when the Soviet Union was unwinding out of control, and the Western press used kind of the hiccuping freedom that was coming to them at that point to dismiss the case by saying, well, you know, there are a bunch of repressed, you know, Orthodox Christians who mystical tendencies are coming to the surface, and we're seeing all kinds of tabloids and ghost stories and paranormal stuff, so we should expect this. But in fact, I became very involved in corresponding with one of the key Soviet investigators on the ground, and we developed quite a warm relationship, and I was several years into researching Rendlesham, and he was literally right there doing the analysis at that point, and we found a number of interesting parallels in physical evidence between the British case and the Russian case. And again, it was pretty much dismissed by the press and treated as a silly thing, but in fact it does seem like there was a landing in this Russian city, a disembarkation, plenty of physical evidence, and dozens of witnesses. So I'll also be giving a presentation on that next month at the Crash Retrieval Conference, and anybody that can join us there, it is a terrific conference put on by our friend and colleague Ryan Wood, and you can go to Ryan's website and register and join us. And bring your gambling money, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's an awesome conference. I went there a few years ago. I had an amazing time. Actually, this is we were kind of laughing about this, Greg. I really don't have anything to plug, finally, for a change, which is nice. I'm going to take some downtime over the next week or two and then start scheduling and taping interviews for Season 5 of BOA Audio. And it's going to be awesome, and I'm really looking forward to it. And we're relaunching the website, like, in mid-November with a whole new look, very professional, sort of glossy look, for the site. I'm really excited about it as well.
I should add in closing that for the first time in some years since we closed down UFOcity.com after almost 6 years, and that already was about 5 years ago, I will be going up with a new website probably within a month.
Oh, excellent.
I believe it's going to be called Peter Robbins Information, and, you know, do a Google search in a couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll be up and running.
Well, excellent. I'm glad to see that you're going to have an online presence again, because it's nice to you have the internet, which we didn't have back in the beginning of the UFO thing.
By cracky, we sure didn't, old timer.
40 years ago, we didn't need the internet. Damn it, you kids!
We walked to school with no shoes and no internet.
That's right. We took pictures of UFOs, and we didn't have no Photoshop to make up other things and stuff to make fake UFO videos in Haiti. And you guys have it so easy.
You had to use an airbrush, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Everybody remember airbrushes? Very good.
Yeah. Uh-oh, there goes the TiVo again.
No, I just dropped the phone. It's cool.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't the government. Good. Thank goodness.
Not again. Well, the next show is in here, Radio Antenna. So I want to thank Nick posthumously, since he's laid out now.
He'll love it.
And
exactly not dead. He's just dead to the world.
And of course, Peter Robbins and Tim Banal, who have all been on the show before, but we always have new things to talk about. And thanks for staying up late your time and gracing the show with your presence. And please, I would like you all to come on again soon, and I'm sure you will. Maybe even after the Crash Retrieval Conference. I'm planning to actually take a jaunt out there for at least a day, and maybe I'll see you and say hi.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for having us. I really appreciate it. It was a great chance to give people who couldn't make it out here the opportunity to kind of get a taste of what we were doing.
Yeah, a little bit.
True pleasure as always, Mr. Bishop. Any chance that you'll be able to join us in Nevada next month?
Yeah, I said I'm planning to make the jaunt out there for at least a day or so and be able to say hi to everybody. Because Ryan actually sent a thing out and said that anybody who has spoken there before can come for on a pass, which I
totally
think is great.
Cool. Nice. Excellent. Yeah. We'll look forward to seeing you then, and I'll look forward to hogging a full 2 hours of airtime and none of these, other people that you bring on. I mean, how do you think that is for my fragile ego? Give me a break.
All these wackos I have on here. You have to listen to Peter. He's the one person that's not a total wacko.
Oh, please. Thank you. Well, I don't know if total covers all of it, but I do have a few brain cells left, and it's a pleasure sharing them with you. Late at night, my brother.
All right. Thanks so much, Peter. Thanks, Tim. And I'll talk to both of you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
They hung up on me. Okay. It's been Radio Mysterio. So we had Nick Redfern, Tim Banal, and Peter Robbins just finished with a conference in Boston, which now I can't remember the name of, and they're going to get very mad at me for. And it's not the Monster Mash. It's the Paranormal Weekend. I can't remember. You can hate me now. Meanwhile, here's some outro music. We'll be back on it again next week with Mr. Fab from Music for Maniacs playing weird music. And it will probably be a Halloween show. I may have my own Halloween show the next week. I'm not sure. Then the week after that, the week after that will probably either be my Halloween show or Miles Lewis from Anomaly Radio. And upcoming guests include Brent Rains, who's not too many people know, but he works very closely or used to with Greg Little, who's another guest I'm trying to get on here. Anyway, lots of stuff coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks for listening tonight. This will be up on Radio Mysterioso. .com within a day or two for download and re-listen to relive all your all of our wonderful memories. Radio Mysterioso Radio Antenna is coming up right now, right after this little musical break. Oh, I found this on the internet the other day. It's Elastica doing a cover of Da Da Da. So, enjoy. Somewhere. Oh, you know what? It starts very slowly. Oh, I turned up the wrong thing. There it is. There it is. See you next week.
What you do and what you don't. What you will and what you won't. What you can and what you can't. This is what you got to know. Love you though it didn't show. Ich liebe dich, du liebst mich nicht. 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 Da, da, da.